beyond price. You know, it's the thing that we've built up over 10,000 years of agriculture. And now in a kind of 100 years of industrialization, we've managed to get rid of most of it.
That's Bill McKibben in The Pollinators. Peter Nelson, you too are a beekeeper. You're talking about pesticides and how they're used in this country. Also, the whole issue of the climate crisis.
Yeah, totally. It's bees are an indicator species, so we really need to pay attention to what's going on because our agricultural system is really dependent upon these commercial bees. You know, agriculture has gotten much more simplified, more monocultures, more chemically dependent, and so it's required to bring these bees in because so many of the native bees that would traditionally have done pollination are not able to live there anymore. So it's become essential to bring these bees in almost as an insurance policy for much of agriculture.
And the agriculture that uses bees?
Oh, it's 400 crops that we eat. It's the most nutritious and nourishing things that we eat. It's the fruits and nuts and vegetables that we eat. Things like wheat and corn are wind-pollinated. Rice is wind-pollinated. But the nutritious, foods that we have are mostly pollinated by bees.
I want to thank you so much for being with us, Peter Nelson, director of the new documentary, The Pollinators. And that does it for today's show. On Friday, Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting and live streaming the first ever presidential forum on environmental justice at South Carolina State University in Orangeburg. Candidates taking part so far include Senators Elizabeth Warren and Cory Booker, businessman Tom Steyer, as well as Marianne Williamson and others. I'll be moderating with former EPA official Mustafa Ali. You can watch it as we live stream at democracynow.org beginning Friday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern. Also, television stations and radio stations will be running it across the country. We'll also be broadcasting from Orangeburg, from South Carolina State, tomorrow morning. Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for paid six-month internships here in New York. Learn more at democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guster, Carla Wills, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thank you.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 5:01. Up next, the evening news.
Gala on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at Polaris Hall in Portland. The Weird Portland Costume Gala and Live Auction will bring together many of Portland's notable eccentrics, including Mo Show the Cat Rapper, former Mayor Bud Clark, Rojo the Llama, Mr. Statue, and Portland's own Elvis. Again, that's the Weird Portland Gala on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 11 p.m. at Polaris Hall, 635 North Killingsworth Court in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater in Portland. Outside the Frame trains homeless and marginalized youth to be directors of their own films and lives. Their annual gala showcases a collection of short films by and about invisible communities in plain sight, young Honduran trans women who walked to Oregon, houseless folks forced to migrate in their hometown, and much more. Again, that's Outside the Frame Migration on Thursday, November 7th from 7:30 to 9 p.m. at the Hollywood Theater, 4122 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tis the season for giving, and KBOO is honored to be chosen for Willamette Weekly's Give Guide. Give Guide handpicked Portland's most impactful nonprofits to help you do good this giving season. You can do good by supporting KBOO's work, amplifying the voices and actions that strengthen, empower, and inspire our community. But we know giving goes both ways. This Thursday, November 7th, donating $10 or more will give you a chance to win $600 worth of new snow gear from Patagonia, a two-night stay at Five Pine Lodge, and four single-day lift tickets to Mount Bachelor. Donate through our website at kboo.fm/give and end the year knowing that you did good for your community. That's kboo.fm/give this Thursday, November 7th.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a Portland police car was photographed sporting a Blue Lives Matter sticker.
Nike's abuse of the fastest girl in America.
And in international news, a Nazi database leak has the potential to identify hundreds of far-right extremists around the world.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, November 7th, 2019. I'm Nat Moon.
And I'm Althea Billings. A Portland police patrol car was spotted with a Blue Lives Matter sticker in clear violation of city policy, which prohibits displaying private decals or markings on city vehicles. Outrage spread online Monday after a photo taken on October 20th was posted of the patrol car near the Stark Street exit off Interstate 205. Portland Police Bureau spokesperson Lieutenant Tina Jones says the police department is, quote, appreciative that this has been brought to our attention and will continue to utilize our systems of accountability to ensure we perform within the highest professional standards. The Blue Lives Matter movement has been sternly criticized as an attempt to equivocate chosen social identity with race. In April, Multnomah County paid $100,000 to an employee for fostering an insensitive workplace by allowing colleagues to hang a Blue Lives Matter flag in the office. That employee was later harassed when she complained to management about the flag.
An online leak of materials from the major neo-Nazi and white supremacist website Iron March was posted anonymously to the Internet Archive site archive.org on Wednesday. The leaked material has the potential to identify hundreds of far-right extremists around the world. The data from the now-defunct Iron March website makes it possible to link usernames to email addresses, IP addresses, forum posts, and private messages. Material uncovered so far has revealed that users registered with email addresses from several U.S. universities, and many of the posts and direct messages suggest some members were on active military service while using the site. Iron March was founded by a Russian nationalist named Alexander Mukitinov and was abruptly taken offline in November of 2017. Members and groups associated with the website have been involved in a range of deadly violence as influential users of the site became more vocal with their support of uncompromising far-right extremism, genocide, and terrorism. The message board has previously been linked with the violent neo-Nazi group Adam Waffen Division and has been widely studied by the Southern Poverty Law Center, a nonprofit that monitors hate groups and other extremists around the country. Adam Waffen Division has been tied with at least five murders, a terror plot, and the violent assault of a transgender woman in Charlottesville. The website has also been linked to Vanguard America, the extremist group that James Alex Fields marched with at the Unite the Right rally in Charlottesville before he murdered Heather Heyer by driving his car into protesters.
A runner dubbed the fastest girl in America was set to be a symbol of women's unlimited potential in sports. But after joining the best track team in the world, she was beaten down by a win-at-all-costs culture that caused her to focus more on her body weight than her burgeoning talent. In 2013, Mary Kane joined Nike's Oregon Project, heralded as the best track team in the world. The team was coached by Alberto Salazar, whose behavior, Kane says, led her to self-harm and suicidal thoughts. Salazar set an arbitrary weight of 114 pounds as Kane's goal and encouraged her to take birth control pills and diuretics, both of which are not allowed in track and field. Kane lost her period for 3 years and broke five bones, leading to fears of infertility and early onset osteoporosis. Kane, now 23, says that at a certain point she wasn't trying to make it to the Olympics, she was just trying to survive. Salazar has since been banned from coaching by the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency for possessing and trafficking testosterone while working at the Nike Oregon Project. Kane's decision to speak out comes at a time when women in all arenas are asserting their own bodily autonomy and using their voice in attempt to protect other women from similar situations.
Presidential candidates have begun filing paperwork to get on the ballot for the New Hampshire primary to take place in February of 2020. With that story and more, it's Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
The primary, when it was written into law, it was for the little guy. It was so that the big shots didn't make all the decisions.
New Hampshire Secretary of State Bill Gardner giving a little history as all the presidential candidates file for the first-in-the-nation primary. To get on the ballot in the Granite State, candidates can simply mail in their paperwork with a check for $1,000, but they often do it in person for tradition and the photo op. Today, President Donald Trump is sending Vice President Mike Pence in his place. Former Vice President Joe Biden did the same for Barack Obama in 2011. The primary candidates, including President Trump, also rallied voters for local and statewide elections in Virginia, Kentucky, and elsewhere earlier this week. The results of those elections were very much on Minnesota Senator Amy Klobuchar's mind as she filed yesterday.
In New Hampshire, where I think 8 of the 10 mayor's races were won by Democrats, and there was a major shift in the town of Laconia, which is very exciting, a town that Donald Trump actually had won in that area, and a Democratic mayor unseated a Republican.
South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg was the first major 2020 candidate to file in New Hampshire on day one. The window is October 30th to November 15th. But the first candidate overall was Mark Greenstein, who instead of a check, had a handful of $50 bills. A perennial office seeker, he was also the first in 2016, one of a total of 58 people on the New Hampshire primary ballot that year. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will decide whether to take up a controversial case brought by relatives of those killed at Sandy Hook Elementary School in 2012. Remington Arms Company versus Soto would challenge a law that prevents gun manufacturers from being held accountable when crimes are committed with their products. Here's California Senator Kamala Harris on the 2005 Protection of Lawful Commerce and Arms Act, or PLACA.
There needs to be an opportunity for people to have a day in court to litigate these issues, and a court will decide. But to have this shield against responsibility is not in the best interest of justice.
It takes four Supreme Court justices to decide to hear a case. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders voted to protect manufacturers in 2005, but he's since decided they do have some responsibility.
If I am a gun manufacturer and suddenly in a small town or in a gun shop where you would expect to sell a certain number of guns, you're selling 10 times more guns. You have and must have the legal responsibility of understanding something is going on. You're not selling a gun to a hunter, but maybe you're selling guns to criminal elements.
In other news, House Intelligence Chairman Adam Schiff announced yesterday that public impeachment hearings start next week. Thanks to Kevin Bowe from Public News Service for today's Sound from New Hampshire. And from Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening.
President Trump's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord has been decried from all angles, with critics warning of its immediate impacts on the environment and on the United States' place as a world leader on climate action. Mark Mitsui is the president of Portland Community College. He is also on the steering committee of Second Nature, a nonprofit which coordinates the actions and strategies of higher education institutions on climate action and sustainability. I spoke with President Mitsui about the United States withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord and what local level people and institutions can do to combat climate change.
My name is Mark Mitsui. I use he, him, his pronouns, and I'm the president of Portland Community College.
Okay, so let's talk specifically about the Paris Agreement. What was the promise of that agreement, and what does it mean that the U.S. has pulled out?
Well, the promise of the agreement were for all signatories to keep global temperature increases at or below 2 degrees centigrade compared to pre-industrial levels. Ideally, keeping it lower than 1.5 degree Celsius in terms of global temperature increases. And the Paris Agreement does require all parties to put forward what are called nationally determined contributions, or NDCs. And so those were the individual national contributions to preventing global warming.
And then for the U.S. to pull out, what does that mean?
It means that the federal government will not put its weight, imprimatur, influence behind our national contributions to the worldwide goal of limiting global warming. And that has a lot of implications around the world because we consume so much energy and we produce so much carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases that when the federal government says, well, we're not in this anymore, then that is a real blow to the international movement. It creates a leadership vacuum internationally, or at least the potential for that. Having said that, a lot of other countries are stepping forward and taking the lead in limiting greenhouse gas emissions and taking climate action. And a lot of state governments, municipalities, as well as institutions like higher education institutions, colleges, universities, community colleges, are, and a lot of community-based organizations are demonstrating that the United States is still in terms of the actions that non-federal actors want to take to limit global warming.
Right. So what will it mean for Oregon as the U.S. withdraws from the climate accord?
Well, I think there are intersections between the federal government and its sphere of responsibility and authority and state government in its sphere of responsibility and authority. On the one hand, we have a governor and a state government and a state legislature that's very dedicated to limiting greenhouse gas emissions, combating global warming, and taking strong positive climate action. On the other hand, with the lack of federal action that overlays all of that, it impacts the total contributions that states can make when the federal government isn't really focused on this anymore. I mean, we can do a lot here in Portland, we can do a lot in Oregon, but we're, of course, one state out of 50. So it really takes all of us together, and it takes all nations together. This is a global issue. The climate, the atmosphere doesn't honor national boundaries, and the effort that has to go into combating global warming really has to transcend borders. And so it really takes a lot of international cooperation. So for the United States government to pull out and say, well, it's not important to us, or at least to the federal government anymore, then that sends a negative signal across the world. I would say the initiatives that are happening here at Portland Community College will continue. We're active in something called the Greater Portland Sustainability Education Network. We believe that not only can we contribute by limiting our own CO2 footprint, but also by helping to educate the next generation of leaders. And GPSEN is one way to do that. It's a program through United Nations University. And one of our faculty, Kim Smith, is really a world leader in terms of developing education networks around the world and across the United States and, of course, here in Portland, in helping raise up the next generation of leaders who will move us forward. We also have a lot of work going on within the curriculum. So a lot of folks may not know that some of the older refrigerants that have been used in air conditioning units are actually 8 times more potent of a greenhouse gas than CO2. And with global warming, a lot more people are using AC, and the proper destruction of those refrigerants will be key in minimizing and reducing global warming. So there are a lot of discussions happening, for example, in heating, ventilation, and air conditioning training programs around alternative refrigerants. And so we're continuing to do what we can within the education sphere by looking at how do we infuse sustainability, climate action across the curriculum, in addition to reducing our own carbon footprint.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Althea.
For KBOO Evening News, I'm Althea Billings.
John Bolton, the Trump administration's former national security advisor, refused to show up today for a voluntary interview as part of the House impeachment inquiry. Bolton's absence is the latest in a series of no-shows that Democrats say will be used as evidence of President Donald Trump's attempt to obstruct Congress. Jennifer Williams, a special advisor on Europe and Russia to Vice President Mike Pence, appeared on Capitol Hill today as planned for her closed-door deposition regarding the July 25th call with Ukraine. In another closed-door deposition today, George Kent, the Deputy Assistant Secretary of State responsible for Ukraine, criticized Rudy Giuliani for engaging in a smear campaign against the former U.S. Ambassador to Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch. Congress's independent watchdog, the Government Accountability Office, has begun looking into whether any laws were broken when the Trump administration froze foreign aid to Ukraine. Meanwhile, President Trump complained today that he wanted Attorney General William Barr to hold a press conference declaring that Trump broke no laws during the July 25th call in question. Trump also lashed out at an attorney for the whistleblower whose complaint about the Ukraine call led to the House's impeachment inquiry.
Five activists were arrested this week for blocking a ship carrying parts for the Trans Mountain pipeline expansion that will threaten land the First Nation holds sacred, as well as further contribute to climate change. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. In Washington, five activists were arrested Tuesday after they blocked a ship from entering the port of Vancouver because it contained a pipeline for the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion project in Canada. Oregon Public Broadcasting reports climbers with Portland Rising Tide and Mosquito Fleet locked themselves to the dock where the shipment was to be offloaded. The activists said the tar sands crude that's transported by the expansion project requires far more water for extraction and refining, and the gasoline made from the crude emits more greenhouse gas. They said they were acting in solidarity with the Fort McKay First Nation, who are suing the government of Alberta because they say the tar sands expansion threatens land they hold sacred. Fort McKay First Nation was recently in the Court of Appeal in Edmonton. Global News reports Chief Mel Grandjam said his people do not oppose oil extraction, but they want their treaty rights respected. Fort McKay is opposing Prosper Petroleum's Rugel project because it would put a processing facility in an area the tribe wants to protect near Moose Lake. The activists in Vancouver were booked for criminal trespass, failure to disperse, and obstruction. This was the latest in a series of actions trying to block shipments for the Trans Mountain Project. The University of Wyoming recently adopted a strategic plan for how to best support Native American students on campus. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports that committee members feel it's coming just in the nick of time, since the university is getting ready to hire a new president.
University of Wyoming's Native student advisor, Raynette Tendor, says it isn't easy for kids to move a long way from home to attend college.
As a Native student, when you're leaving the reservation, you look for somebody that can kind of support you through everything because of all just the unique needs and challenges that we face as Native people, leaving the reservation, first of all, to come to a predominantly white campus is a struggle.
That's why former UW President Lori Nichols hired Tendor to make that transition easier. As president, Nichols also met with tribes in person and tackled a strategic plan to bring up Native student enrollment. But last spring, the university's Board of Trustees opted not to renew the president's contract.
We were shocked and disheartened due to the fact of that she has just worked hand in hand with us and really sat down at the table and really just tried to identify barriers that Northern Apple tribal members go through when trying to get an education.
That's Northern Arapaho Business Council Chair Lee Spoonhunter. He says he's worried the new president won't prioritize tribal relations like Nichols did. Native American Advisory Council Chair Ken Giroux worked on the new strategic plan and says the goal is to transcend the personalities that come and go in administration.
I'm taking it as part of my personal agenda to make this as a matter of fact. This is part of what UW does, Mr. or Mrs. President, whoever that is, and get behind us because we're rolling.
Giroux says the plan sets goals to bring on more Native American faculty, pursue research relevant to tribes, build a larger Native American center, and more. The Board of Trustees hopes to hire a new president by next spring. For National Native News, I'm Melody Edwards.
Authorities have not released a cause of death for two people who died over the weekend on the Navajo Reservation in New Mexico. KOAT-TV in Albuquerque reported 14 others were injured during a ceremony that took place in a traditional hogan on the Alamo Navajo Reservation in Socorro County. Officials with the tribe said the ceremony lasts through the night and there's an open pit fire in the structure. It began Saturday night, and early Sunday morning, a woman reported finding a man and woman unresponsive on the floor. A Navajo police spokesperson said 14 others were treated for smoke inhalation. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Support by Freedom Lodge, inviting you to a 200-hour intertribal historical trauma masterclass where you can learn a body-based approach to trauma reconciliation. Free of charge program for tribal members. Registration deadline is January 10th at freedomlodge.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on BARC, the grassroots watchdog group dedicated to protecting Mount Hood National Forest. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then, at 7, tune in for Urban Funk. Tonight's weather, mostly clear with a low of 37. Tomorrow, expect partly cloudy skies with a high of 62. Today in history, in 1921, Suzanne Herzl was born. Herzl was a member of the White Rose, a nonviolent, anti-fascist, intellectual resistance group during the Third Reich, led by students and a professor at the University of Munich from 1942 to 1943. The quote of the day is from another anti-fascist, George Orwell, who said, quote, "In a time of deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act."
American rapper T.I. has come under fire for stating publicly that he takes his daughter to the gynecologist for virginity testing to make sure her hymen is still intact. According to medical experts, there is no exam to verify virginity, and performing these exams is a violation of rights. The hymen is an often misunderstood part of the female anatomy. It is a thin membrane that partially covers the entrance to the vagina, but it may be more prominent in some people. The hymen can be torn or stretched during any number of activities, including bike riding, athletics, tampon use, or medical procedures. Some people with vulvas are born without hymens. According to the American Medical College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, quote, "the presence or absence of a hymen does not indicate virginity." The World Health Organization has condemned virginity testing as unethical, humiliating, and traumatic, and advocate that it should be banned. Journalist Sophia Jones wrote of the issue in Marie Claire, quote, "When doctors legitimize virginity by conducting fake tests for it, they arguably uphold one of the oldest lies used to control women, that whether or not a woman has had sexual intercourse determines worth." T.I.'s daughter, Deja Harris, has not commented publicly since her father's remarks surfaced. However, she has liked tweets calling his behavior, quote, "disgusting, possessive, and controlling."
30 fifth grade students at Columbia City Elementary are preparing for a once-in-a-lifetime voyage. The students will soon launch a mini-boat across the Pacific Ocean, and students in Japan will launch their own mini-boat headed for the Pacific Northwest. Since 2017, the Columbia River Maritime Museum has brought their mini-boat program into local schools to give kids a chance to reach across oceans and across cultures. 5th to 7th graders in the Pacific Northwest and Japan cooperatively design, build, launch, and track seaworthy GPS-equipped boats on a journey across the Pacific Ocean. Over the past 2 years, over 1,200 students on both sides of the Pacific have been involved in the launch of 21 mini-boats, which clock in at 5 feet long and 5 feet tall. The project was inspired by the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami in 2011 after debris from Japan reached Oregon and Washington shores. One of the items that washed up was a fishing vessel, now on display at the Columbia River Maritime Museum. The mini boats have collectively traveled over 53,000 nautical miles and are tracked daily by students who continue to hone their skills.
The Australian women's soccer team is celebrating today as an agreement has been reached with the governing body to give the men's and women's teams equal share of player-generated revenue. This will lift the women's salaries from about $38,000 a year to $57,000. The deal amounts to a 90% raise in guaranteed minimum payments for the women's team, known as the Matildas. Conditions will also improve for the team, with the deal providing greater support for pregnancy leave, as well as parity in training conditions and business class travel on international flights. Australia has now joined other countries like Norway and New Zealand in improving pay and working conditions for their women's soccer team. This is in contrast to the United States, where the U.S. women's team's lawsuit alleging gender discrimination against U.S. soccer is set to go to trial in May 2020, since mediation between the two parties broke down.
The Compassion Leadership Summit takes place this weekend at the University of Washington, where community leaders will share tools that can help create more compassionate and mindful workplaces. Eric Tegedov has more on the story.
Workplace and community leaders come together this week to focus on how compassion can play a bigger role in our lives. The Compassion Leadership Summit is being held at the University of Washington, co-hosted by the school's undergraduate women in business. The two-day event features topics such as dignity for all, creating compassionate cities, and how to support the next generation. Martha Ensign with Enjoy Productions, one of the summit's presenters, says they'll also discuss compassionate disagreement, an important tool during these contentious times. She says one goal is to realize you can't make people think a certain way.
I can work on the tools that I carry in myself, which doesn't mean I roll over and believe what you say. It simply means I can learn how to build bridges. I can learn how to listen. I can learn how to have appreciation for different perspectives.
Ensign says summit goers will share tools for creating more compassionate and mindful workplaces and communities. The summit is Friday and Saturday. Alex Schwartz with the Human Values Center is part of the summit on youth. She says youth are being raised in a culture of fear right now, but have decided to stand up and have their voices heard. She says more compassionate workplaces will encourage people to stay longer and be interested in their work, and we should think about how to create these places alongside youth.
We need to hold space that's non-judgmental and that is safe for these youngsters to come in and share what they think is working, what they think is beneficial, what they think would impact in a positive way, not only their community, but everything around them.
Ensign believes the more compassion people can feed into the systems around them, the more they will thrive. And that has value for individuals as well.
If we're all connected, then there is a value to creating a space that is more just, more loving, kinder, more filled with humor, because it will impact me directly, because I am part of this whole ecosystem.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedov.
The Portland Bureau of Transportation will be offering free leaf pickup starting this week. On your street's leaf day, rake all the leaves into a pile on the street about a foot away from the curb. Make sure there aren't any obstacles, such as your car, a basketball hoop, or garbage bins, to prepare for pickup. Picking up leaves is important, as they can make streets slippery and clog up storm drains when it rains. Leaf Day service covers 52 districts in Portland that have more street trees than average. If you're not in one of those districts, don't rake your leaves into the street. For more information on Leaf Day pickup, head to portlandoregon.gov/transportation.
The Portland Youth Philharmonic will be opening its 96th season this Saturday, November 9th at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in downtown Portland. KBOO's Ken Jones sat down with the musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic, David Hattner.
Portland's changed a lot since 1924, but there's been at least one constant. Besides those rusty downtown drinking fountains, our own homegrown orchestra, the Portland Youth Philharmonic. PYP will be opening their 96th season this Saturday, November 9th, at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall. They'll be performing two pieces by American composers, George Gershwin's Piano Concerto and Amy Beach's Gaelic Symphony, in addition to Brazilian composer Oscar Lorenzo Fernandez, Batuca. In what's become a very joyful tradition for us here at KBOO, we welcome David Hattner, musical director of PYP, to tell us more about the opening concert and PYP's 96th season. David, thanks for coming into KBOO today.
It's great to be here again, Ken.
And happy 96th.
Oh, thank you. Yeah.
Now, since it is the 96th, before getting into the program itself, let's talk a little history. PYP started back in 1924, and it makes them the oldest youth orchestra in the United States. The symphony was originally called the Portland Junior Symphony instead of PYP, and their first public performance was in 1925. Is there a record of the program and venue?
Yes, we have all of the printed programs throughout the history of the orchestra. Fortunately, there were always savers involved, and that concert took place on Valentine's Day, February 14th, 1925. At what was then Lincoln High School. It's now Lincoln Hall at Portland State University in the auditorium there. And the orchestra, I believe, was about 48 at the time, most of whom were violinists. They were still trying to fill all the chairs. And among the compositions were Schubert's Unfinished Symphony. That was the first major piece of repertoire that they've played. And that piece has come up at anniversary seasons from time to time.
So it's kind of the iconic piece for PYP.
And, well, it's such an important piece of music in the orchestral literature, and it just happened to be the piece that Mr. Gershkovich passed out at the first rehearsal and had to encourage the musicians that they would be able to play it.
Now, you won't be playing that piece at the 96th season opener, but you will be playing Gershwin's Piano Concerto. Mm-hmm. And that piece actually debuted in 1925. I don't know if it was Valentine's Day, but somewhere around that year. And like much of Gershwin's work, the concerto is a blend of classical and jazz influences, would you call it? Or
I would say so. It's a classical piece in all respects. Other than that, some of the inspiration in terms of the themes that Gershwin uses to create all the developments of the movements are based in popular song form, primarily the Charleston. And then if also some of the harmonies have some blue qualities about them. Therefore, it has an incredible populist appeal. When Maurice Ravel wrote his piano concerto in, I believe, 1932, some of the passages in it have the fingerprint of the Gershwin sound in them, although it's entirely Ravel's creation. Some of the harmonies are clearly inspired by Gershwin's concerto.
The next piece we're going to talk about, David, is not just a first for your orchestra, but apparently a first for Portland, and that's Amy Beach's symphony, a Gaelic symphony. And that piece goes back even further, before the PYP and before Gershwin, with its first performance by the Boston Symphony in 1896. And why did you pick that one? Again, kind of a Portland premiere, maybe an Oregon premiere?
Well, part of our mission is to expose young musicians not only to the most standard works in the repertoire, but also perhaps some things that they should be aware of, so that when they're programming their own concerts in the future, they'll know to look in some unusual places. And it's unfortunate that Amy Beach's music is unusual, because when restudying the score after many years of not thinking about it too much, it occurs to me, and every time we rehearse it, I think the same thing, of what a great symphony it really is. It's probably the first great symphony by an American composer. It happens also to be the first published symphony by a American woman composer. And it was very popular with the Boston Symphony audiences for the first 20 years of its existence. I believe the Boston Symphony has not programmed it since 1917. But during those years between 1896 and 1917, it was played frequently. And the audience always applauded vigorously, particularly after the second movement. Back then, audiences were very free applauding in between the movements. But
and you allow that, or actually encourage it.
We encourage it. I think it's a natural response to the music. But she decided, a little bit in reaction to Dvorak's New World Symphony — this piece was written soon thereafter, and it's in the same key and follows some of the same formal development themes — to use the music of Irish folk tunes, particularly for the middle two movements. That's why it gets its name, Gaelic.
The Gaelic.
The first movement and last are based a lot on a song of hers called Dark is the Night. And stormy music, I think, is supposed to represent the perilous journey from Ireland to America with the stormy seas. She herself was not Irish, but the city of Boston, of course, is heavily Irish and remains so. And it's a remarkable piece of music for a composer not yet 30 years old.
And there's actually a very long, informative blog post on the PYP site that I read, and I was fascinated because I had never heard of Mary Beach. Well, you mentioned she's not played much now, but she apparently was pretty well known at the time, both as a composer and a pianist. There was a very interesting part about Dvorak. Apparently, he visited the U.S., and he had this kind of a challenge or mandate for American composers to create a national musical idiom by means of, I'm quoting here, a Negro melodies. Many critics think that this is in response to that, but the blog post pointed out that she was actually somewhat opposed to something like that. Now it's called cultural appropriation, but it wasn't at the time.
Right. Her feeling was that not knowing that many African American people and not having heard in the course of her early life this music, it wasn't a natural source for her as a composer. She didn't necessarily object to the idea of what Dvorak was suggesting, but she rejected it for herself as a composer. And the Gershwin Concerto makes an interesting companion piece because Gershwin, of course, completely embraced the idea of using African American sounds and idioms and rhythms in his music. And it's because of that American music, not just American classical music, but particularly American popular music, took over the world. It became so popular. So Dvorak was really on to something. But he was, of course, a musical nationalist of the bohemian sort, you know, the bohemia of the country, not the attitude, what we would call the Czech Republic now. And the wellspring of his own compositional output is the essence of Czech folk music, because Dvorak almost never set any actual folk tunes. He wrote his own melodies, and he seemed to have an endless supply. But they were from that environment where he came. The environment where Amy Beach came from was not filled with that sort of American folk music, so she decided to use Irish folk music.
So it's interesting, the two attitudes there between Gershwin and Amy Beach. But of course, there's no way we're going to be able to resolve that cultural appropriation issue.
Right, and also just a different era, and she was born into a sort of middle class and married into the upper class, whereas Gershwin was very poor.
Poor Jewish.
Lower East Side, Second Avenue, Jewish ghetto. It's funny, I've often wondered if Gershkovich and Gershwin have maybe some similar ethnic backgrounds, because Gershkovich was from
Russia.
He was actually from Siberia, but basically Russia, and so was the Gershwin family. And of course, once they come across, names get altered slightly, and so who knows. But in any case, yes, Amy Beach is an old New England composer from that New England school, you know, Payne, Chadwick, and such. And they were much more European in their outlook than the next generation of composers, who would include people like Gershwin, who were more authentically American and sort of absorbed all American influences rather than, you know, starting from the standpoint of wanting to be more like Brahms.
Well, David, again, thanks very much. Always a pleasure to talk with you. Thanks very much for previewing next Saturday's program with us for Portland Youth Philharmonic.
Yes, thank you. Everyone is invited to the concert. We are open to everyone, even if you've never been to an orchestra concert. You don't have to wear anything special or know anything. Just come in and listen to the music and react naturally. These are really the concerts for the people. They're priced for the people. And this is an authentic tradition that is unique to Portland, this orchestra, and people should come and celebrate the fact that the young people in this community have access to this sort of opportunity.
A tradition going back 96 years, and hopefully another 96 and more.
Absolutely. Thank you, Ken.
We've been talking with David Hattner, musical director of the Portland Youth Philharmonic. PYP will be opening their 96th season on Saturday, November 9th, 7:30 p.m. at the Arlene Schnitzer Concert Hall in downtown Portland. For all PYP concert details and tickets, you can go to their website, portlandyouthphil.org.
For Thursday, November 7th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories and your tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Althea Billings and Nat Moon. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Chris Gates. The director of Evening News is also Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. My co-host has been Nat Moon. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Sojourner Truth Radio. At 9, Beloved Community. At 10, Radio Zine presents Between the Covers Special, where KBOO's Ken Jones interviews Melissa Mathewson, a Southern Oregon writer and author of the new memoir, Tracing the Desire Line. At 10:30, it's Film at 11, which will bring you a discussion of horror master Val Lewton and the new adaptation of Stephen King's Dr. Sleep. And at 11, it's The Digital Divide, with an update from Edward Snowden. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air at kboo.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. Want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming? Then download our mobile app today. We'll be right back.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
It may surprise some listeners to know that the U.S. Forest Service is not an organization solely dedicated to the preservation of our nation's forests. Instead, their charge also includes selling timber from these forested lands for profit. BARC is an Oregon nonprofit watchdog organization dedicated to protecting, preserving, and transforming Mount Hood National Forest. Their work has helped shape numerous timber sales in the area while advocating for the wilderness and the public's right to access it. Today, we are speaking with Courtney Ray, the Associate Director of BARC. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, for listeners who have not heard of BARC before, can you tell me about what your organization does?
Sure. BARC is a volunteer-driven watchdog group, and so the staff support concerned members of the public in investigating what's going on the ground in Mount Hood National Forest, specifically looking at the commercial timber sale program that the Forest Service facilitates on the public lands, and then surveying those proposed areas before the logging happens to ensure that we are protecting mature and old growth forest, our drinking water sheds, and more we're looking at protecting the carbon that is sequestered in the forest from destructive projects.
What kind of things does BARC do to augment and slow timber sales?
We do a lot of things. We do everything that we can possibly come up with. There is a public process around the National Environmental Policy Act, the National Forest Management Act, that directs the Forest Service to make the public aware of any activities it intends to carry out on public lands and then receive input from the public, which should be incorporated into their final projects. So we start by getting access to the maps and the purposes that the project proposes to undertake. And then we send volunteers out, put boots on the ground, as we say, to document the different ecosystems that are threatened. That includes everything from the plant community, the botanical community, to wildlife, threatened and endangered species. And then we look at the condition of the forest in terms of, has fire been a part of the history? Has logging been part of the landscape's history? And we're looking for things that are special, things that have legal protection, and things that we believe, even if they don't have legal protection, are rare or particularly important to the ecosystems that we have remaining and the structures that we have remaining. And with that information, we then go into these federal processes, the NEPA process, and provide those details of site-specific information, we say, to the Forest Service, asking them to look again at what they're intending to do, make adjustments so that they aren't logging in areas that are sensitive or could have a negative impact on wildlife or water hydrological function and things like that. And then there can be a long kind of bureaucratic process that starts there and sometimes ends in legal action, as is not often, but if we do need to take the agency to court because we believe that their project is illegal, then we will.
Right. And so I understand BARC is working on a Free Mount Hood campaign, which calls for an update to the Mount Hood Forest Plan. So what's wrong with the plan as it stands right now?
Probably the biggest concern that we have is that it is 30 years old and has never been updated. And so everything from our understanding of fire ecology to our understanding of climate change is much advanced from 30 years ago. And the Forest Service is still working with basically a job description and a set of priorities that doesn't take much of what has changed over the last 30 years into consideration. 30 years ago, timber was the strong priority for National Forest Management and the strongest economic driver maybe at the time. Now we know that recreation and cultural resources and cultural values are more important, and that those are negatively impacted by commercial extraction and logging. And so while with the Forest Service continuing to use an old plan, we're actually working at odds to what the public and the ecosystems really need, with so many things having changed in the socioeconomic level and at the ecosystem level. So we are pushing for the agency to undertake some amendments, some updates. Ideally, an entire overhaul would be great, but at the very least, we would like to see requirements around protecting carbon that is stored in the forest and monitoring for the impact in terms of carbon emissions or loss of climate resiliency that projects would cause, were they to, which is not something that the agency has to take into account right now when they're planning their projects.
Are there other examples of forest plans changing in our area?
Not quite in our area, not right now. In 1994, the Northwest Forest Plan was established, and what that did was update, kind of, it amended all of the forest plans in the region of the northern spotted owl. And so that was the last time that any forest plans in our region, the Pacific Northwest region, all the Washington, Oregon, Northern California National Forest, got any significant updates. There are a couple forests in the Rocky Mountain region that are doing some updates. But unfortunately, some of those are really focusing on increasing access to timber access rather than moving away from that timber focus to ecological restoration and climate resiliency, which is something that we know people in the area around Mount Hood are really concerned about. And to put that public concern to work to update this management plan is what Fremont Hood's all about.
Awesome. We have a late coming guest.
Hi, my name is Tara.
Thank you so much for coming. So I understand you're a volunteer with BARC. Could you tell us a little bit about how you got involved?
Yes, I've been volunteering with BARC for about 6 or 7 years. I actually started off canvassing with them and just really fell in love with the organization, with their mission to protect the forest, with the level and the depth of the way that they engage with the community and that they engage with the issues, really getting into some nuance. It's a really, I think, holistic group, and it also is a group that really is fun. And so I love the mission. I have a lot of fun with them. I've learned so much from them. So it's been a great experience continuing to volunteer with them.
And you've taught a lot of people a lot of things too. Another thing that's really impressive, I think, about the volunteer community that we have is everyone is bringing different knowledge and skills, as well as then exchanging them with other volunteers. And so Tara has experience in theater and group play, and so a lot of those kinds of activities really help people to understand our work in a different way and give more people just different ways to access the information, which can be, there can be a lot going on in terms of studying ecosystems and studying policy at the same time. So thank you for that, Tara.
So you have an upcoming event, the Radical Activist Training, next Thursday on the 14th. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Sure. First of all, Radical is R-A-D-I-C-L-E, and it is a reference to the first part of the plant that emerges from the seed. That's called the radical. And so, right. So it can play a couple of different ways, but what Radical is a program that is designed to take people who are concerned about the health of our environment or people who love the forest, give them the skills and resources to become advocates. And so the training that I'm leading next week is called Defensive Forest Campaign Planning. We'll be looking at a timber sale that we've recently learned about called the Zigzag Integrated Resource Project. And we'll be kind of, I'll be sharing with the participants the steps that BARC takes, some of which I've already talked about here, to address what's happening in a particular timber sale and then take that from the ground to the public and then back to the agency to seek changes and ultimately to cancel the sale if we can.
Very cool. So we're going to have to wrap it up right there, but we have been speaking with Courtney Ray, the Associate Director of BARC, and Tara, a volunteer with the organization. More information on BARC and their upcoming projects can be found on their website at bark-out.org. Thank you so much for being here, both of you.
Thank you.
I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Nat Moon. Thank you for listening to KBOO News in Depth. Stay tuned for Rose City Native Radio.
The time is 5:58. Up next, Rose City Native Radio.
KBOO Community Radio holds an open meeting concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio is having our annual book and record sale on November 23rd, 2019 to raise funds with support from the Willamette Week Give Guide. From classic books to coffee table books to cookbooks, treasures will be waiting for your discovery and just in time for the holidays. Right now, KBOO is accepting used books and records in good condition. Now through Friday, November 15th, listeners, members, and supporters can drop off donations during business hours at the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. After hours appointments can be made available. For more information, please call 503-231-8032 or go online to kboo.fm.
You are listening to a digital indigenous radio show. All across Turtle Island, turn up your radios and decolonize. This is